Conservative. Constitutional. It's the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, keeping you informed on what's going on right here in Kentucky.
Today on the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, we'll be joined by Tony Florence, a vapor shop owner and an activist, to talk about House Bill 11, a bill that will take effect in January that will ban tens of thousands of e-cigarette and vapor products that are currently on the shelves right here in Kentucky. I'll go over with him exactly what we can expect when that legislation takes effect, and it's pretty horrific as far as the wide-ranging effects of that, of unemploying thousands of people and shutting down hundreds of businesses. First, I had a viewer question that I mentioned yesterday from a Giannis asking about Jefferson County races. For those of you who don't know, that's also Louisville. And I wanted to dig into that. For those of you who are unaware, there isn't necessarily just a ton of primaries that happen. In fact, out of the 100 House races, so there's 100 seats, and they run every 2 years, so that means there's 100 available races. Out of those 100 possible Republican primaries, there are only 20 Republican primaries. And what's funny is there's 16 Democrat primaries. And I just want to mention that because, you know, Republicans hold 80 seats in the House. They are clearly in the vast, vast majority. There's not much power to be had by being a Democrat in Kentucky. But despite that, Democrats are still able to field enough candidates to be able to have 16 primaries, and Republicans only have 4 more, despite the many other races that Republicans actually have where primaries more worthwhile. Because if you don't have the seat, it's, you know, in the safe ruby red districts and the same in the safe blue districts, primaries are the races. And so we have more safe red districts, but by percentage, less primaries than Democrats do. We also see statewide 40 races that are completely unchallenged in the House. There are 40 incumbents, or actually in some cases, not incumbents, it's an open seat and only one person filed for it. But we see 40 races where the person is already decided who's going to win. It's there's no votes to be casted because only one person signed up to run. So with so little primaries going on and really not even a whole lot of races, there's something interesting happening in Louisville in House District 29. House District 29 has not 4 people in it, not 5, but 6 people running for that seat. 3 on the Democrat side in the Democrat primary, and 3 on the Republican side. And since my viewer asked me to talk about those races, I thought it would be worth digging into. Now, the reason why you're seeing so many people running for this seat is because the prior incumbent is actually running now for city council in Louisville. Bratcher, Representative Bratcher, he's running for Louisville City Council, vacating the seat, making it an open seat. And the Dems look at that as a possible seat to pick up in. I think it's a hard claim. I mean, when you come around to presidential election years, they're looking at 4 years ago. They're looking at Trump's favorability. And you know, the urban Republican is a little more liberal than the rural Republican. And so the urban Republican was a lot less likely to like Trump than the rural Republican. And so they're somewhat banking on those situations in some of these more urban Republican seats that they could possibly have a pickup because of presidential election politics. And so that's why you're seeing so many on both sides. They believe it's a purple seat and you have an incumbent backing out. But we're going to be focusing on the Republican side, where we have a Wyatt Allison, a Chris Lewis, and a Debbie Pedden running for those seats. Now, full disclosure, I am not very personally familiar with these people. So it's not like I know their hearts. It's not like I've talked to them a lot about political philosophy, as I have with a lot of legislators and a lot of people running for office. But I haven't with any of these threes. I know of one of them specifically. I've come across him. I've shook his hand before, but I've never really sat down and talked with him. So instead of trying to dig in and be really weird, not weird, but nerdy about digging into this race and reaching out to all the different sources I have to find out more about it, I decided instead to do what maybe a normal voter would do if they wanted to learn more about a race and research them by going onto their website. So let's start with Wyatt Allison. And what we can learn on his website is he does have six, quote-unquote, key policies. I have no clue what these six policies actually mean. I mean, he does list out categories under his six key policies, because that's what I'm looking at. When I'm logging onto a website, the first thing I personally look at is, do you have an issues page? And if you do, what does it say? And so on his issues, his six key policies are empowerment, education, economic growth, healthcare, infrastructure, and environmental stewardship. Now, I have no clue, though, what those six key policies actually mean or are or do. What's that translate into policy? Because he has no policy listed. I mean, let me give you an example. So under economic growth, which I would have questions about because I want to know if it just involves a redistribution of my tax dollars. He says, when we support small businesses and entrepreneurs, we help build a thriving state economy. I will pursue policies that foster an environment of sustainable economic growth and job creation. That's all it says. Like, what does that actually mean? So instead of knowing what kind of actual policies you put in place, because there's a lot of ways to achieve that, a Democrat and a Republican could say the exact same thing, but mean two totally different things. So I'm left with just looking and trying to learn what I can. And what I learn from Wyatt looking at his website is that I probably won't like him very much. Because when I look at his six key policies, the first one he listed was empowerment, and the last one he listed was environmental stewardship. The other ones were education, economic growth, and healthcare. And when you're using words like empowerment, it sets off alarm bells with me because you're speaking now the language of the left. And that tells me that this guy may claim that, well, you got to be a centrist and this is a purple district and I'm going to vote as a centrist or basically a Democrat with an R next to my name. But Bratcher wasn't exactly the incumbent who held that seat for a while. Wasn't exactly the most purplish guy when it came to the voting records, his statements, his actions. He was actually a lot more conservative than most, in my opinion. I'm not saying that it means much because the bar was set so low by our so-called Republican legislators in the House, but he's not exactly super liberal. So the fact that this guy's listing out these things, it's hard to defend by saying, well, it's a purple district and I want to remain attractive to as many people as possible. Now, once again, I don't know anything about these candidates in depth outside of what I'm seeing. So even if you like this guy, don't take offense to what I'm saying. I'm just explaining what's going on through my head as a conservative Republican looking at their websites. And for what little info there is there, it gives me concerns. Now, we can also look at Chris Lewis. Chris Lewis, I actually know a little bit better, not much, but I know him a little bit better. I've come across him at Republican events and gatherings in Louisville. I've never, like, talked to the guy, though, in depth, but I'm a pretty oblivious voter. Now, right off the bat, Chris does have a pro-life mention, which Wyatt did not talk about. Wyatt didn't mention the Constitution one time on his entire website, but Chris has a conservative values tab where he mentions his pro-life stance, protecting the Second Amendment, his belief in transparency in government. He does list things like tough on crime, lower taxes, improve education, create jobs, fight the drugs, homeless crisis. And he does have a little bit more info under each that gives us some idea of what his policies might be as he mentions prior actions within those categories, but he still doesn't necessarily give us a whole lot of concrete, super concrete policies. When you start talking about things like economic development, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? So we'll be going over a little bit more into this after this break. You're listening to The Andrew Cooperator Show, your source for Kentucky politics. And you're back with The Andrew Cooperator Show. So before the break, we were digging into a race I don't know as much about. And so I was walking you through how you as a voter should look at things. And that's House District 29 in Louisville has three Republicans running in the primary there for the open seat, a Wyatt Allison, a Chris Lewis, and a Debbie Pendon. And we've looked at Wyatt, his websites. I'm just looking at their websites, learning what I can about them. We've looked at Wyatt. What have we seen? We've seen a very scant on policy, but On top of that, we have the red flag of listing things like empowering and environmental stewardship as one of his six key policies without much explanation. And without that explanation, and you're using the language of the left there, it certainly raises some alarm bells. Then we're looking at Chris Lewis. We see that he does have policies listed. He does talk about the Constitution, something Wyatt didn't. And he has a little bit more detail when we take a look at his page. Because when we look at something like, the issues he lists on his website is things like tough on crime, lower taxes, improve education, create jobs, fight the drug/homeless crisis. And he does have a little bit more info than Wyatt did as far as his actual policies that gives us a better idea. For an example, under crime, he lists that he helped implement ShotSpotter while being a staff member on the Louisville City Council. So that gives us some idea of maybe what he's done on things. On lower taxes, he does say he would cut the income tax to zero. So that's an actual policy. But on most of the issues, he lists one kind of general goal, or maybe mentions some experience he's had that can give us some inclination on what he wants to do, but it doesn't give us a whole lot of information on concrete exactly what the policies are. So based upon what I'm seeing here, though, initially I'm saying Chris is better than Wyatt, just based upon what the site mentions, and Chris goes more in detail. But I do have a red flag for Chris, and that is that he has a bachelor's in political science, which is kind of odd, I know. But anytime I see people running for office that have a degree in political science, I give a pause. And the reason why is because that tells me that you are maybe a person who's wanted to be in office for quite some time, who's wanted to be a lifelong politician enough so that you got a degree in being a politician in political science, basically. And so that gives me pause. Have you been trying to run for office your entire life? Have you wanted to be involved with politics your entire life? And if you view it as a career or a goal, how has that shaped your actual beliefs and what you actually want to accomplish? Has it been about the job, or has it been about principle? That's a question to be asking. So, and then finally in this race, we see a Debbie Pinden. So Debbie also has issues listed on her website, things that is like fixing education, addressing crime, better the economy, stop illegal immigration, improving infrastructure. Now, there is one initial kind of red flag and one question for me when it comes to Debbie, when I'm first looking at her website, Debbie Pinden here. The first red flag is she lists stopping illegal immigration. Now, I don't have a problem with stopping illegal immigration. That's a fantastic thing to do, but that's not exactly something a representative in the state house has much to deal with. It's actually a joke amongst us who are heavily involved in electoral politics that when you poll on top issues for people in things like state house reps, state Supreme Court races, state Senate races, local judge executive races, the top issue is often immigration, even though that position has nothing to do with it. And so you list something, you say something about it just to appease those people who that's their top issue. And the fact that Debbie lists that tells me that she does most likely have a consultant. And I only know of two consultants in the entire state that are not connected with the establishment. And so that gives me pause. She may be connected with the establishment through that. I'm just judging based on the websites. Now, there's other ways I can dig into them, and I'll probably do tomorrow, kind of do that, look at them a little bit more. But just based on that, gives me pause. And then the question I have is that Debbie is a prior or current school teacher. And when it comes to school choice and you have somebody that's a school teacher, I want to know where you stand on that. Well, luckily, Debbie does have an education tab, and what do we find is that she says she is for school choice. She says it numerous times on the page that she'd like to increase educational options. But one thing that is odd on that page, though, is she says she wants to increase the per pupil funding for JCPS. JCPS already spends $23,000 a year, though. So she may have some esoteric argument about school choice would cause more poor pupil funding in local schools, even though overall funding goes down, possibly is her argument there. But the way it comes across is it comes across as a concern. Are you saying you actually want to give JCPS, who's spending $23K a year getting horrible results, more money to continue getting horrible results? I don't know. Now, for the rest of her issues tabs, they're pretty good. Not super duper concrete on solutions either, but I would say better than the other two, but only slightly better than Chris. So right now, if I'm a voter, I'm looking at Chris and Debbie, Chris Lewis and Debbie Pinden, trying to decide which one I would want to vote for. Those are my options right now. So this is just my opinion from what I'm seeing just off their websites, literally. So go ahead, tune in tomorrow. I'm going to dig in deeper into this race. I'm going to go look in some other places for some info to maybe get where voters won't look, but it's available to all voters, to kind of tell you how I'm going to work my way through this. But if you also have some info on this race that I feel like sharing with me, feel free to email me at info@theandrewshow.com. Once again, that's info@theandrewshow.com. Now, I'm being joined by Tony Florence. He's a founding board member of Smoke-Free Association. Is that Kentucky Smoke Free?
It is Kentucky Smoke Free Association.
There you go. Okay, Kentucky Smoke Free Association. He's a board member of the Kentucky Hemp Association. He's a business owner. He owns 723 Vapor in Nicholasville, correct?
And Lexington and Louisville.
In Lexington and the Vapor Stock Room.
Vapor Stock Room.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Vapor Stock Room. And he's coming on today to talk about House Bill 11. Now, longtime listeners, and by longtime I mean you've been listening for a couple of months, will have heard me talk a few times about House Bill 11. But as a quick reminder to everybody, House Bill 11 was passed this year and it banned any vapor product, e-cigarette type product that was not in approval process or being approved or approved by the FDA. And, effectively speaking, it's said to greatly affect a lot of our businesses going on here. So I wanted to ask Tony on to go into depth. What is the on the ground effect of this bill? And practically what, if House Bill 11 comes into full effect, what will we as Kentuckians see happening?
Well, fundamentally, when this bill comes into effect January 1st, is you're going to see about 450 electronic cigarette vapor stores go out of business. And what that will do, unfortunately, is it will deny the 450,000 Kentuckians who vape access to these much safer, less harmful products. And unfortunately, what that means is a lot of them will go back to smoking combustible cigarettes, which will entail a lot of people dying down the road.
So we're talking about 450 some odd businesses closing. We're talking about, people and I don't really want to focus too much on the debate. I don't know how much of a debate it is. Is vapor better than cigarettes? And I would have to say, I think most people believe it's at least somewhat better because it just doesn't smell as much in secondhand smoke. So I think at least from the other people's standpoint of things, it's not as harmful to other people as secondhand smoke is. Is it as harmful to you or not? I don't particularly, I don't think that's necessarily what's being debated here per se. That's not what the bill's about. That's not what they've said it's about. So you're saying that it's going to close down these stores. How does House Bill 11 exactly do that?
Well, basically what House Bill 11 does, it will only allow on the market items that have had full PMTA approval by the FDA, or a very small number of products that filed an application for approval between 2016 and 2020 to stay on the market. And what this does is it shrinks what was once a very robust and innovative market with tens of thousands of products down to a very small handful. It's like 8 product lines plus 8 products that are manufactured and sold by Big Tobacco only.
And so that would be, what product line? Are we talking about like Juul?
Juul has a stay, Vuse, Enjoy, a lot of those do. And then if you look at the other options that are not Big Tobacco, there are a couple of lawsuits that are pending that will allow those products to stay on the market. And then there's some really just outdated, older products that are just still lingering around that the FDA has not gotten around to. And you have to understand the verbiage there, why this is a bad thing. You have to go to the federal level on this, because on the federal level, the FDA regulates e-cigarettes, right? I mean, that's their job. And in 2016 to 2020, they said, hey, you have to fill out an application for these tobacco products to stay on the market. And instead of getting just a few thousand. They got 6.5 million applications, an overwhelming amount of applications. So a lot of these applications are still pending. They just don't have the manpower to address it. So what the FDA has done is they're like, hey, you know, some of these big tobacco products, they've gotten the approval. For these tens of thousands, millions of other products that we're still looking at, we're going to allow you to stay on the market. We have this thing called discretionary enforcement. As long as you're not child appealing or stealing someone's IP, you can stay on the market until we figure out on our end whether you're safe or not or can pass the PMTA process. And from that point, the FDA has never asked any state, hey, we need help regulating these products, because from their perspective, they got it handled. Well, what Big Tobacco has done in 20 states this year was they put forth this registry bill, and the registry bill basically says, hey, we're going to weaponize the state to enforce it so that only the stuff that has 100% approval, or only the things that are still in this application process from years and years and years ago, can still be on the market. And that's the short of it.
So we'll talk about the motivation for passing it and kind of what you're doing to fight that after this short break. We are coming up on a break. You all are listening to the Andrew Cooperator Show, though, your source for Kentucky politics. We'll be back in a few short minutes. And you are back with the Andrew Cooperator Show. For the break, we are digging into House Bill 11 with Tony Florence. Tony Florence is a founding board member of Smoke Free Kentucky.
Kentucky Smoke Free Association.
Kentucky Smoke Free Association. I have fallen over that. It's in my notes, but I didn't write Kentucky first. That's the problem. I wrote it at the end. He's also a board member of the Kentucky Hemp Association, business owner, owns 723 Vapor and Vapor Stock Room. And we are talking about the practicality of House Bill 11, a bill that bans tens of thousands of vapor products and how that affects them. So the bill says that if the FDA hasn't approved it, or if it's not in the approval process, it can't be sold in Kentucky, even though the FDA at the federal level hasn't taken the step to say themselves, hey, these can't be sold unless they've been through the approval process. You know, you've said it's basically seven lines of products plus like another seven one-off shoots and things like that. Now, I can say that I watched the floor debate on this, and Rebecca Raymer, who was the bill sponsor on this, claimed that it was anything that's been put in for approval, not just the seven. And so that it's actually, I think she said, tens of thousands of products she mentioned. Is that accurate? What's she getting wrong there?
Not even remotely close. Because the thing is they put in a safe harbor window. So it's not any product that is under PMTA, the approval process. There's the safe harbor window is the PMTA had to be submitted between 2016 and 2020. Now, as everyone knows, e-cigarettes is a very innovative market. Things are constantly changing. They went through like synthetic nicotine for a while. They changed the formulas for things. So there are not very many products that are still on the market from 2016 to 2020. And the example that she liked to use is in Alabama, they have a very similar registry bill. And on that registry bill, there are 1,600 products. And that was the big argument. Oh, well, there's 1,600 products available. Every store will be fine with that. But the reality is, if you looked at those 1,600 products, a lot of them were actually nicotine pouches, or they were big tobacco products, or a lot of them were just devices, hardware to utilize the e-cigarette liquids. And when it got right down to it, if you looked at what was still commercially available, it was seven lines of seven brands, totaling flavor-wise about 160 total flavors, but there were a lot of repeats in there. And if you look at it, you got to understand it, in the e-cigarette market, you don't just have a strawberry. You have a strawberry with four or five or six different nicotine levels, and those each count as a different SKU, but it's still strawberry, you know. So yeah, it's not as many as you would think. And their argument there was, well, Alabama has a very robust e-cigarette market. Well, Alabama also has no enforcement. We have friends and affiliates in Alabama, and they said, well, the reason why we can stay in business in Alabama is because we don't obey these rules. We never get inspected. It's been 18 months. They've never been inspected once. And so we just sell whatever we want to. And even in the session in Alabama this year, not to digress, they actually tried to put a law into place to fund the ABC down there so they could have manpower to enforce these laws. But there is none. So you can really easily say, oh, it works down there. Well, it only works because there's no enforcement in Alabama.
And so if let me know if I'm summing this up properly. So what the bill does is it does allow more than just like seven products. But the problem is a lot of the products, because the window was 4 years ago and then only for 4 years to be even considered to be allowed by this, that practically speaking to what we currently have available on the market, it severely limits down the available stock to the point that as we look around and we see all these vapor stores, whether you like the vapor stores or not, they're there. I mean, I think there's a lot worse businesses that could be there. But anyways, right. Whether you like the vapor stores or not, they're there. And what our government has done, and the practical effect of House Bill 11, is it will shut down those 450 some odd stores because just... like that, because the products that they're selling weren't able to get in place during this window, or the vast majority of them, and they would end up only having, six, seven things to sell. How many things would they actually have to sell? So take your stores right now.
Right.
How many of your products that your store currently sells would you be left to sell, and how many that you currently sell could you replace with some other product that you think would fulfill this law?
Well, as far as what I could currently sell, that number would be zero. I don't currently carry any big tobacco products because I'm against those. And as far as the handful of lines that would still be allowed to be sold, I don't carry any of those products. And if you look at the cross-section of most of the stores that are in my organization, every once in a while, one of them might carry one or possibly two of those lines that would be legal. But in general, the vast majority of them, none of them carry these
and
products.
And they can't replace them with one that would be legal. There's nothing similar that's legal?
Exactly. Well, I mean, there's similar flavor profiles out there. But the thing about vaping is, much like eating or drinking, we've curated a customer base that have utilized a very specific set of products for their journey to quit smoking, right? But like, if you're a big fan of Five Guys Burgers, and which I am, and you were told you can only have McDonald's burgers, and that was the only burger you could have, you might just quit eating burgers because McDonald's burgers are kind of gross. But we have curated a number of customers, tens of thousands of them in Kentucky, and there's products that work for them. And when you suddenly say, hey, you can't have those products anymore, what's the natural activity? Well, bootlegging, for one, they'll get it on the black market. Or two, the worst case scenario, they go back to smoking cigarettes. Or three, they just find some place on the internet to get it.
I think one thing you said before we came on the air that was interesting, if I get limited down to maybe practically 10 products, I've got 2,000-3,000 square foot stores that used to sell this big stock of different options.
Yeah, which corner do you want me to put that in?
Yeah, I mean, that really shouldn't be an argument you per se have to make, because, I mean, you can go into cigar places, Jake's Cigar Bar and Lounge, wine stores, liquor
Fantastic
stores.
Place.
It would be like saying you could only buy one kind of bourbon,
right?
And you can't buy any other kinds of bourbons. There may be, if you were particular to rye bourbons, and now you can't get one of those because it's been pushed out. Well, now you're like, maybe I don't want to drink bourbon at all. That's right. Certainly understandable. Raymer on the floor said the motivation behind passing it was that they were worried about kids, the children. Now, it is already illegal for kids under 21 to access these products, but they're saying, and flavor profiles, they're very candy-like. And so it's not that you're just helping people stop smoking, but you have kids who would never start smoking, but because vaping tastes good, they're vaping. What do you think the actual motivation was?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, the motivation was big tobacco. Like I said, they pushed us forward in 22 states. And if you look at Altria's like earnings sheets, they basically have told Altria to make sure your profit margins go up, you need to have more people smoking cigarettes. And Altria's response was, well, we're working with legislators. So I don't think of anything more damning could be said than that, because that's what this bill does. It bans a competing product and it makes people go back to smoking cigarettes. So that's really the motivation. But on the surface, that doesn't sound good to the average politician or average citizen. What does sound good is, oh, it's always about the kids. It's about the kids. Now, the problem is if you go back historically and you look at when this got bad, and many of you know of the Juul product, Juul was advertising to minors and all that kind of stuff. That's when youth usage skyrocketed, spiked. And the way they determined that is there's something called the NYTS, the National Youth Tobacco Survey, comes out every year, and it analyzes how many kids are using dip, how many smoking cigarettes, cigars, whatever, and e-cigarette usage. And in 2018, 2019, you saw a huge rise because of Juul. and they demonized this industry. Now, what has happened, though, since 2019, every year there's been a statistical decrease in youth usage. Now it's down to two. If you have to go back to before 2013 to get a lower level of youth usage of e-cigarettes, it was a 40% drop this year over last year of e-cigarette usage amongst kids. But none of the politicians wanted to hear that. I mean, that's a statistical fact from the exact same study that was used to villainize us just a handful of years ago. So it's not really about youth usage if the rates are going down. And they're always like, hey, you know, it's always the flavor. You know, kids love flavors. Well, actually, adults love flavors too. And I mean, if I'm an adult, and use the bourbon reference, if I'm an adult and I'm an alcoholic, if I was given the choice to drink, I don't know, fruit punch or something versus drinking bourbon flavored water, I feel like I would want to drink fruit punch or whatever have you that's not bourbon flavored. It's the same thing with tobacco. If I'm a quitter, I don't want to be reminded of the delicious flavor of tobacco. I want to do other things. So even amongst adults, it's like 98% of them used a flavored product. So I think it's disingenuous to say, oh, kids are lured by the flavored product. Everybody with taste buds would prefer a flavored product.
Well, we got to take a break here. We'll be back here in a few short minutes. And you're back in this final segment of the Andrew Cooperwriter Show. We've been digging into House Bill 11 with Tony Florence. And we've kind of gone through a lot of the details on it. So if you're just tuning in, you'll have to head on over to theandrewshow.com here at 1 o'clock or a little bit later and see where you can listen to old episodes, and including this one, as we put out a new episode every day, Monday through Friday at 1 o'clock on all podcasting platforms, as well as going out on WZXI at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. Monday through Friday. But we've been digging into House Bill 11, a bill that bans thousands of tens of thousands of e-cigarette products, will put 450 or so vapor stores out of business, how it affects its practical effects. And Tony, I do remember Rebecca Raymer, the sponsor, saying that Big Tobacco didn't talk to her, had nothing to do with it, and didn't say anything about House Bill 11. But when the lobbying reports came out,
oh yeah,
Big Tobacco had spent tens of thousands of dollars lobbying on.
Not only that, there
House
was
Bill 11.
There was a lot, and she said Big Tobacco, one of her favorite quotes was, Big Tobacco is against this bill. And then you can juxtapose that side by side with advertisements saying, this bill is great, everyone should support this bill, supported by this advertisement done by Big Tobacco.
Right.
So what is it? And her argument also was, oh, this was all original, we put months and months of effort into this bill. Well, then why is it the exact same bill magically appeared in 22 states across the nation this year, all being backed by Altria and RJ Reynolds and such? I don't know. Seems
a little fishy. Yeah, it does lead to some questions. So this bill's passed our legislature. You know, it's people try to sound the alarm, try to get legislators involved to stop it. Legislators didn't. So they passed it. What hope do the vapor stores have now of are we expecting to see 450 business owners and thousands of employees lose their job here in what, June
or January?
January. Mm-hmm. June is, you know,
typically.
Yeah. So
they did have a clause
that
in there because of the thing about it is they went and said, well, stores won't be closing down. But the main reason they put the January 1st active date on this is because she was afraid of the repercussions of all these stores losing their leases and not having enough time. So which is it? Are stores not going to close down? And if so, why did you put this January 1st activation?
Well, also you want them to happen after election time.
Oh, absolutely, right? Where you're going.
Let's just go straight, man. Okay. Let's be honest here. That's 2 years from the next election.
Exactly.
A lot safer. But anyways, and so they shut this down. Are you all out? What are you guys doing to fight back? What can we see any changes on this?
Well, there's a few things going on. One, I think you're going to see a lot of businesses attempt to pivot into the cannabis side of things and the hemp side of things. I'm not sure if that will work because that space is already pretty full. There's already a lot of head shops and that kind of stuff out there. And more importantly, we're really focused. There's a lawsuit the venue hasn't been selected yet, but I think it's going to be in Franklin County. And it's a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of HB 11, because what has happened is they put this ill-conceived bill, the House version, and then Senator Storm had the Senate version. And when it was all done and told, they kind of merged them together. So there's some constitutionality issues with how the phrasing is in that bill, because the way the bill stands right now is it makes anything that is a vaporable vaporizing product illegal. So not only nicotine, hemp products, marijuana when it becomes legal, your room humidifier would be illegal. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there that would be illegal because the way it's worded is that any vapor product not approved or authorized by the FDA is illegal. Well, the FDA doesn't have authorization on hemp products and
eucalyptus vaporizer. Exactly. For like a room where you put a little.
Yep, they don't have authorization over that. So by that verbiage, it would be illegal. And the thing is a nicotine bill. So we're going to challenge the constitutionality of the bill. And hopefully we can get at least components of it changed or the entire bill thrown out.
Well, and also too, I mean, if you're able to delay it, it does give an opportunity in this next session to try to undo it, though, without a large amount of, you know, involvement from the citizenry. I don't know how you change the tide. I mean, why should Kentuckians care real quick? And what should they do to kind of make a difference on it? If you don't vape, why should you care?
Well, I think the biggest thing is we all know people who have died or become ill from a smoking-related illness. I mean, I personally don't vape, but my dad passed away from lung cancer, okay? So I think this has much broader reach than just, I don't vape, so I don't care. These products are known to be 95% less harmful. Royal College of Physicians in England, there's a lot of studies that say it's less harmful. I'm not saying it's harmless, but it's less harmful. And so if this is a safer outlet that will prevent Kentuckians from dying, isn't it in our best interest to make sure these products are available to adults? So that's why everybody should care. And what you can do
more. And plus, me as a citizen of Kentucky, it makes me very uncomfortable that we have a legislature that just came in and has effectively closed 450 businesses without really much debate or a second thought. I mean, this bill kind of came out left field. It's not like it's been working its way through the legislature for a while. I don't know if you saw any warning signs in your industry before this kind of session, a few months leading up to it. You're more tuned in. Yeah. Did it kind of come out left field for you guys at all?
So we had known, our lobbyist and our organization had known that Big Tobacco was pushing these bills in a lot of other states. So we went to a member of House leadership before the session started and said, hey, do we have to worry about this? And his exact words were, no, we're just focused on enforcement and penalties. There'll be no registry bill. So we didn't think it was going to be a big deal. And then out of left field, a couple of weeks before the deadline for submitting a bill, we get word there's a registry bill, but it'll be fine. And it's a classic example of legislators passing laws on things they know nothing about because they did not know the repercussions of this. They don't even know the industry. I would wager 95% of the legislators who voted on this bill have never even been in a vapor store or know anything about it.
No, I would say that's probably accurate. What can people do? People want to help fight this. You got your lawsuit filed. Is there anything the people of Kentucky can do to aid in saving, I guess, an overreach by government, small businesses being put out? As I said before the break, it makes me very uncomfortable that we have a government without a second thought putting 450 small businesses just out like that. And especially odd when we look at the overall effect on society. And while I understand there's a lot of people out there that maybe don't like vapor stores, they don't smoke e-cigarettes, they don't smoke, whatever. I think that most of us would agree things like porn stores and strip clubs are maybe, if we're going to put 450 businesses out of business and you're talking about the good of society and people,
right?
If we're going to be in that business, not saying we should be,
right?
But if we're going to be, I wouldn't think e-cigarette stores would be where we start. And so if people want to say, look, this is ridiculous, this is government overreach, what should they do?
Well, the thing that really surprised me was how many vapers knew politicians personally. We managed to get a lot of meetings because of the personal relationships folk had with their representatives and their senators. And that would be my big ask. If you don't vape, but you have friends or family members who do, reach out to those people and say, hey, you know, I heard about HB 11. This is going to affect my cousin. This is going to affect my mother. This is going to affect my dad. Can you just maybe have us think about this again? Reach out to your local vapor store, because every district has vapor stores, and see what their thoughts are. And maybe go and visit some of these people who aren't going to be in business in 7 or 8 months, you know, and maybe change your vote should we manage to get better legislation down the road so you don't arbitrarily make 2,500 people go out of business. Yeah. Or 2,500 people lose their jobs.
Lose their jobs, right, absolutely. Well, Tony, thank you for joining us. Next time I've got a question about
thank
something
you for
going
having
on,
me.
I'll reach out to you, okay?
Appreciate it.
Once again, guys, that was Tony Florence, founding board member of Kentucky Smoke-Free Association. Board member of the Kentucky Hemp Association, and he's also the owner of 723 Vapor and the Vapor Stockroom. So there you go. If you all want to reach out, ask him some questions, I'm sure you can look him up there. Now, Tony, thank you so much for joining me. That's all the time we have available today on the Andrew Cooperwriter Show. I do, once again, appreciate you stopping by. But we'll be back here tomorrow to all my listeners. If you want to reach out to the show, feel free to reach out at info@theandrewshow.com. Once again, that's info@theandrewshow.com, or head on over to theandrewshow.com. Click the contact tab there. You can reach out there, but also you could check out old shows there. Hit the listen now tab. Check out shows that we've done here in the past. If you want to stay up to date on everything going on right here in Kentucky. Otherwise, I'll see you guys back here tomorrow. Hope you have a great rest of your day.